Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 5th of November, the day, of course, after the midterms. What happened in Wisconsin and why, and what happened nationally and why this hour of the program? Craig Gilbert will be starting us off momentarily. Later in the hour, Jill Lawrence, a columnist for Creators Syndicate and Al Jazeera America, and John McCormick, who's a senior writer for the Weekly Standard, will concentrate on Wisconsin, the first part of the show, nationally second, and we'll be welcoming your phone calls and email messages all hour. So here's how you reach us: 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can find us on Twitter as well at K Dunn Show. Craig Gilbert is the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel Washington Bureau Chief, has joined us many times before for all things political and has been writing extensively about the gubernatorial race, has a front page story today, A Familiar Path to Victory. Craig, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Nice to be with you.
So he put together, you write, the same coalition of voters on Tuesday that elected him in 2010 and 2012. Is my memory failing me? The state looked a lot redder to me as I looked at all the counties than it did in 2010 or 2012.
No, it's really the same.
Is it really? And it would appear that in order for Democrats to be successful in this kind of race, they're really counting on Dane and Milwaukee counties to vote in huge numbers, and that would determine a Democratic victory. I mean, huge numbers.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, Democrats lose when they're, you know, when they're reduced to depending on just those two counties, and when their, you know, their base ends up being only urban voters. And so in elections where Democrats are successful in Wisconsin, they are more competitive with rural voters than they were in this election. They're obviously a little bit more competitive with suburban voters. And they, you know, in the Obama elections, we saw he did well. He won a lot of counties. So this is a familiar map in a Republican kind of victory scenario. And it's it also does kind of reflect this pattern we've seen in recent political cycles where Republicans have had the upper hand in races for governor, and Democrats have had the upper hand in races for president.
Mm-hmm. Is there something special about the way Scott Walker campaigns? Is he a really good politician?
He definitely has impressive political skills. I don't know if it's sort of this, you know, how he does on the stump. I think he's a very experienced politician who's been in lots of campaigns, and he's very comfortable speaking in public and communicating with the media. He's kind of a political animal, and that can be a real asset to a politician. Mm-hmm. You have that comfort level. It shows. You can think on your feet. You don't make the kinds of mistakes that kind of rookie politicians make. And so those are all things that Scott Walker has sort of going for him. And he also has going for him the extreme loyalty he inspires in his own base, and his ability to mobilize those voters. And so that's hard to overcome if you're running against him, when you have somebody who's not only turning out lots of his own voters, but you know, none of them are defecting. I mean, they're all voting for him. Mm-hmm. And this is sort of the Wisconsin of today, where both parties are so polarized. I mean, this election, even though essentially it was a replay of the 2010 and 2012 elections, it was actually even more polarized by party, where you had, you know, Democrats getting even more of their own voters, and Scott Walker getting even more of his own voters, and fewer voters in both parties crossing over.
Mm-hmm. But Democrats not getting as many of those loyal voters as Republicans do in the state. Why is that? Does it say anything about the beliefs of the candidates, the strengths of the candidates?
Well, I think Democrats were less enthusiastic and motivated in this election. Again, part of this is sort of the difference between midterm and presidential elections, where the presidential only voters tend to be more Democratic. But it's not just that. It's also, you know, this was a terrible environment for Democrats this year, as things turned out. I mean, one reason why I think it was plausible to think this would be a closer election than 2010 was that 2010 was like, you know, one of the most conservative electorates we've had in decades, and yet this election turned out to be almost as much of a Republican wave and a conservative tide as that election. So, I mean, Scott Walker has benefited from running in two of the best sort of Republican cycles in anybody's memory, and you did not see, you know, you may have seen what one Republican incumbent governor losing yesterday in Pennsylvania,
right.
But so it was a, you know, it's not just midterm and presidential, it's also the climate,
mm-hmm.
and the climate is driven in large part by having a president whose numbers aren't very good and have gotten worse in the sixth year of an eight-year presidency.
Everybody knows that the economy was front and center for both candidates in this campaign. You write about exit polls showing half of Wisconsin voters saying the economy was their number one issue. 4 in 10 are very worried about the direction of the economy, and they are mixed about Wisconsin's economy. Under half thought conditions were better in Wisconsin than 4 years ago. 4 in 10 say the situation in their area was better today than 4 years ago. I would have to assume that Governor Walker won on that issue. How did he do so?
Well, people are seeing the economy through a partisan lens. And so if you look at Walker voters, they're many, many, many times more likely to say the job situation where they live is better than it was 4 years ago, and the economy is better than it was 4 years ago. And if you look at the Burke voters, they're going to say the opposite. So so he did, in the end, you know, I think the economy was enough of a mixed bag that it turned out not to be a real negative for him. I mean, the Democrats did have an issue, which is running on jobs and running against his jobs record, in the sense that, you know, Wisconsin has been lagging other states in terms of private sector job growth, and there was this promise that didn't get met to create 250,000 new private sector jobs. But it wasn't, you know, the economic picture was also mixed. I mean, the unemployment rate was down, and, you know, Governor Walker had other things he could run on as well. And there was a debate over the true state of employment and the job picture in Wisconsin. Again, people are seeing that through their own filter, and we saw that in this election.
Mm-hmm. His acceptance speech last night, he was obviously within the first couple sentences, speaking way beyond Wisconsin, I thought.
Yeah, and I actually missed most of his speech because I was busy wrestling with a story. But, you know, that's where it's natural for all of our heads to turn who write about politics now that we're immediately entering the next presidential cycle, and we have not just Scott Walker, but Paul Ryan from the state of Wisconsin as potential Republican presidential candidates. So everything, you know, if it wasn't true before, it's true now that almost everything he does will be seen by some people through the prism of a potential presidential race.
Mm-hmm. Wouldn't you say, though, that when national political people get together and look at who would be more likely, that they would be more likely to go with Walker and to embrace him? Because Ryan didn't help bring the state to Romney during the presidential election.
Yeah, I think, I don't know. I think you'll get disagreements about that. I think I've heard people all over the map on that question. I think they each have their, you know, their positives and negatives as potential presidential candidates. If you look at national polls, I mean, Paul Ryan, you generally get more support among Republican voters nationally. And obviously, that's probably to some degree from serving on the ticket in 2012. I don't think people saw him as you know, dragging down the ticket in 2012. I think, you know, vice presidents don't really do that. And it's not reasonable to expect him to have delivered his home state as a vice presidential candidate. You know, there's a real open question as to whether Scott Walker could deliver Wisconsin as a presidential candidate because of the way Wisconsin's been voting in presidential elections. In fact, in the exit polls yesterday, the same people that voted 52% or 53% for Scott Walker, only 42% said he would make a good president. The number was slightly higher for Paul Ryan. So, You know, it's you can make a case for either one. I don't think they're both going to run. I mean, who knows? Maybe neither one of them will run. But they each have different, I think, ways to run and different arguments to make. They obviously have different personal and political calculations to make about whether they want to do it and whether they can do it.
Governor Walker is meeting with his cabinet today. He said he's going to tech colleges tomorrow. Do you, from following this race, have a pretty good idea of what his plans are for the next 4 years, Craig?
In terms of policy?
Yeah.
Well, yes and no. I mean, he's governed for 4 years. I mean, we know we have a pretty good idea of his policy agenda, his policy views now. Certainly better than we did, you know, right after the 2010 election. You know, there are some wild cards. I mean, he's got a even more Republican legislature, which could, you know, sometimes Republican legislatures give their governors fits in the same party because they push the envelope even further than the governor wants to push it. If he's truly has his eye on the presidential race, you know, he may have a different idea. That may give him a different idea of what the state should be doing legislatively than his legislators have. So I think there are some questions about how he's going to, you know, solve the structural deficit in the budget, if there is one, you know, how he's going to deal with issues that he may not be pushing, but the legislature may be pushing on him.
We welcome phone calls for Craig. We have a couple minutes to take phone calls. We'd like to concentrate on Wisconsin. We'll move into national races as we move on. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. You can always send an email, and that's talk@wpr.org. Jeff in Eau Claire, our first caller for you, Craig. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. I'm very glad to be on the air on this. Your show so far is very forward-looking, so I apologize for taking a step back with my question. And I will keep it about Wisconsin, although it's a national issue. One of the biggest debates going into the election was the subject of voter ID. And there was a great call for the requirement of voter ID to prevent voter fraud. So first, I would like to say, since voter ID was not required at the election time, was prevented by the Supreme Court. Is there any evidence? Does anybody have any stories in Wisconsin of anyone going to the poll to vote and finding that their ID had been stolen by somebody fraudulently and their vote was prevented? That's one. Two, this subject is going to come up again, I do believe, because it allows for voter disenfranchisement of people that skew Democratic, that it will come up in the 2016 election because that looks like it's going to swing towards the Democrats as far as what seats are being battled. So any discussion on that, I would be interested in hearing.
Thank you, Jeff. Thanks for the call.
Well, Republicans have already talked about, quote, election reform going forward in Wisconsin. You do have this photo ID law that's kind of in legal limbo. So we could have a change. I mean, it could happen. There is not much evidence of voter fraud that anybody can really point to. Even though there's, when you ask the question in a poll, a majority of voters has said they support the idea of a photo ID requirement. You know, Republicans, I think, have been told by their party that there's voter fraud going on, and the very close elections in 2000 and 2004 at the presidential level in Wisconsin kind of reinforced that notion. I don't think there's a lot of evidence for it, and so that gets you know, into the argument over what's the effect and impact of making some of these changes in the voting process. But it's you know, we're going to see more debate and action on this front.
Senator Alberta Darling was quoted in today's paper as saying that she anticipates bold reform agenda on taxes, schools, and jobs. Would you agree that that's what the governor will be looking at? And specifically on schools, do you think that there will be a vast expansion of vouchers in the state?
Well, there's some talk about that. I mean, I don't cover the legislature, so I have, you know, some of my colleagues would know more about that than I do. But there has been there are signals that there will be an expansion. There will be a push for an expansion of the voucher program.
Thanks very much, Jeff, for the call. Jim in Waukesha. Hi, Jim. Jim, are you there?
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Go ahead.
Okay, I'd like to pose the question about the blame game and its effect on Wisconsin results, voting results. How did the blame transfer from a do-nothing House of Representatives to blame Obama, which affected the results in Wisconsin, I think?
Well, I mean, obviously there's a lot of finger-pointing and there's discussion and argument over who's to blame for gridlock. I mean, gridlock is, you know, a feature of divided government now in our system when the gap between the parties is so big. But the fact is, whoever you blame, it's more often the party of the president that is punished at the polls because that's who voters typically hold accountable or responsible for what's going on in Washington.
I wonder about the president's appearance in Milwaukee, and we'll talk about this a little bit more as the show goes on, but I vote in a predominantly African-American ward in the city of Milwaukee, and there were a lot of people at the polls yesterday out the door after work. A lot of people were wearing Obama sweatshirts, and I can assume that most of the people in that room were voting Democratic. And it did make me wonder about the ability of the president, which seemed to me to be still strong, to bring minority voters to the polls.
Well, I haven't, you know, gone through all the numbers yet. I'm still kind of looking at that question myself in terms of what the turnout was. Overall, turnout was really high. I mean, it was the highest turnout we've pretty much had as long as I have numbers. I mean, going back to at least 1950 in a midterm election, even though it was a little bit lower than the recall. So it was a pretty remarkable turnout, and it was certainly really strong in Republican areas. I haven't yet gone through the numbers in places like Milwaukee and Madison to see how the turnout compared in relative terms to the previous two elections, whether it was you know, disproportionately low or not. Again, I don't know if you could say that was sort of the decisive factor in this election or not.
Mm-hmm. And finally, Mitch McConnell is speaking, as you know, as we are speaking, the new majority leader of the Senate. He has had some interesting things to say about what they'll be able to work with the president on. He mentioned trade agreements and tax reform. He did say, because a lot of people are wondering what will happen with the Affordable Care Act, if I had the ability, I would get rid of it. But obviously, the president is still there. It's no secret that every one of our members thinks Obamacare was a huge legislative mistake, put states in a deep hole. Your response to any of those?
Well, you mean, will the Affordable Care Act be revisited?
Right. And do you think that they'll be able to, Republicans, work with the president on trade agreements and tax reform?
I think there are some issues potentially where they could work with each other. I mean, not every issue is absolutely polarizing. Obamacare is one that is, so I don't think there's going to be much working together on health care. But there could be some working together on some issues related to taxes. And trade has typically been one of the more bipartisan issues. You know, immigration in the past at times has been bipartisan, although it's less so now. So I think there are issues where there's more partisan agreement and there's issues where there's more partisan disagreement. We saw in the exit polls that, you know, a large minority of Scott Walker voters favors raising the minimum wage, but I don't think the Republican Party in terms of its political leadership favors that. But you've got issues on both sides where there's potential crossover in the sort of popular coalition for an issue. It's just that because of the, you know, the division and differences between the parties in Washington and at the state level, it's hard to get those things done.
Thanks very much, Craig. Thanks for
all
your reporting.
Okay, it's a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks. Craig Gilbert, our guest, the first part of the show. He is Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, focusing on the Wisconsin gubernatorial race, which may have national ramifications. As we are speaking, as I said, Senator Mitch McConnell is giving a press conference. It will be followed by the president giving his first public response to what happened yesterday. So we're keeping an eye on that. Scotty Myers, our producer, is looking at that. So we're going to weave what their comments are into this conversation as well. We continue. Our next guest is Jill Lawrence, columnist for Creators Syndicate and Al Jazeera America. She's written some interesting things before the election, saying if there is a gap between reality and perception, it's at least partly because Democrats have thrown their record under the bus. And she will talk more about that, and we'll probably say that's one of the reasons the losses were so large for the Democrats yesterday. And we'll be welcoming more phone calls. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jill Lawrence joins us now, columnist for Creators Syndicate and Al Jazeera America. Hello, Jill. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. Good to be here.
We're going to hear from the president a little bit later, but you wrote this very interesting piece. He was so absent from many, many states. If there's a gap between reality and perception, it's at least partly because Democrats have thrown their record under the bus. Why did they do that, and how is their record good?
Well, you know, they accomplished a lot in the first couple of years they were in office, and it all got washed away in the election of 2010. But if you look at what's happened since then to the economy, I mean, every number is fabulous, and the Affordable Care Act has really helped a lot of people, probably many more than it's hurt, although you wouldn't know that from what anyone's campaigning on. Mm. So they've just kind of detached themselves from the president. They've detached themselves from their own record. They've let Republicans depict the country as in a complete mess, that conditions are terrible. And everyone's very pessimistic, and I think the president and the party have let that happen by not, having a strong counter-narrative and setting the frame of this election. So, I'm not surprised what happened, to tell you the truth.
It is surprising that any political party would do that. I tend to agree with you. There was not a strong counter-narrative, and everybody was walking away from the president, didn't even vote for him or wouldn't say they had voted for him, is to be correct about that. It was fairly unusual. Were they looking at polls? What were they looking at to decide they were going to give
him? Yeah, I mean, a lot of them were running in these red states, but, you know, so the question is, do you try to tone yourself down and pretend you're not a real Democrat, or do you make the best case you can for what you stand for? And, you know, what you're talking about with Alison Lundgren Grimes not saying if she voted for the president or not in Kentucky, that was kind of the epitome of this problem.
It was.
And I mean, it's, you know, I understand that there was some caution involved because of the terrain. But on the other hand, you know, a record is a record. If you made the votes, certainly there's parts of the president's agenda that people support, the minimum wage increase, that sort of thing. So, you know, I just don't see any reason why they couldn't have made a much stronger argument.
Were there any races in which the whatever the strong narrative is from the Democrats, where it was used and to great success or not?
I don't think so. I mean, I think maybe in Michigan, where the president went, you know, there is a strong case based on the auto industry bailout. But on the other hand, Rick Snyder won. The Republican governor won. And now the Senate candidate won there. The Democrat won mostly because the Republicans put up a weak opponent. But, you know, Rick Snyder won, and now he's probably in contention as a national candidate, maybe a vice presidential candidate for a Republican. And he's been a good governor.
Let's go to phone calls. We have many of them. We want to take as many as we can. Eugene and Viola, hi.
Good afternoon, Kathleen, and to your guest. With taking 67 votes to override a veto, anything the Republicans propose, the Democrats sort out the White House can veto. So the Republicans are going to have to go to the Democrats if they want to get anything done. So we may wind up with another 2 years of gridlock. And I'll take comment off the air.
Thanks, Eugene. Jill.
Well, I think that's very possible. Now, Mitch McConnell, I think, to go back to the earlier question, I think one of the reasons Democrats were so kind of stunned into silence about their own record is the audacity of Mitch McConnell and the Republicans promising, if elected, to end gridlock when they've been the primary agents of gridlock for the last 6 years. Suddenly now that that Republicans control the Senate, they're ready to work with the president. And apparently some Democrats are. But it all depends on what Mitch McConnell tries to do. And, you know, if he decides to pass all the laws that the House passed, the House always talks about its 46 jobs bills, I put quotations around that, then those are not Democratic priorities. Democrats don't agree with most of them. They include repealing Obamacare. They include the Paul Ryan budget. This is not the kind of thing that's going to get Democrats and Republicans working together. So, you know, we're just going to have a different kind of gridlock. It's either going to be it's going to be the veto kind of gridlock.
Well, we've been keeping an ear on his press conference. He talked about energy bill, that we haven't had an energy bill in years. It needs to be more than Keystone Pipeline. I have a feeling that there's a great difference between many Democrats and many Republicans when it comes to our energy future. He also mentioned trade agreements and tax reform as areas where he could work with the Democrats.
Well, you know, these are issues where Democrats themselves are divided. So that'll, you know, he'll be putting some Democrats on the spot. I mean, it won't be that critical right now, right after an election, as it would have been right before an election, which is why you didn't see Harry Reid bringing a lot of these things up. But, you know, do you want to make Mary Landrieu vote on some of these energy bills? You know, there were a lot of people, the Democrats are divided on fossil fuel type industries. They're divided on the Keystone Pipeline. They're going to be divided on trade, depending on whether there's a big labor element in their state. So, you know, it's complicated, but I do think that he's right. He can peel off some Democrats on these issues and possibly get them passed. And, you know, Obama is going to want to have some kind of legislative legacy for his final 2 years and is going to be willing, has already said apparently to McConnell that he's willing to deal.
Mm-hmm. This comes in, Jill, from Tamara on Facebook. I am so depressed and disheartened. Do people really not care about the environment, our education, medical care, etc.? And is there anything that we can do about the severe gerrymandering?
Well, the gerrymandering can't be fixed or even changed until the next census in 2020. And most states don't have very systematic ways of doing it. It depends on who's in power. And, of course, Republicans are in power in most of these state legislatures, even more after yesterday. So that's very bad for Democrats. I mean, some people are talking about a whole Democratic reset, trying to find ways to talk to white, more middle-of-the-road or even more conservative voters, so they don't lose the white vote so dramatically every 2 years. That doesn't change the gerrymandering situation, but it could, in some marginal districts, improve Democratic prospects.
Richard in Eau Claire, hi.
Hello, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I think this whole election showed that there is still hope for this country and, of course, in our state of Wisconsin. And what I mean, I think there was a big voice that said we have to get back to our moral roots, our moral compass, so to speak. And we'd lost that in the last few years. The fact that we've been killing 1.5 million babies every year, the fact that we're okaying this radical homosexual agenda with marriage between other than a man and a woman.
All right. Jill, you want to respond to that?
Well, I will just say that there were a couple of personhood referendums on the ballot in two states, and I think North Carolina and Colorado, and they were rejected. And these are rejected every time they're on the ballot. So I don't think people want to go further down the road towards abortion restrictions and even contraception restrictions that some people say these amendments would impose. So I'm not sure whether that's the correct interpretation of this. And also, some of the lowest turnout rates were among young people, and they're the ones to whom these issues are important in mm-hmm. a different way than what your caller is talking about. So I'm not sure I would draw conclusions like that at this point.
Well, you even look at what happened, the referenda in the state of Wisconsin, and exit polling, same-sex marriage. Over half the people in Wisconsin said they thought it was fine. And in terms of minimum wage was interesting. It looked like every state that had this on the ballot had pretty overwhelming support for an increase in the minimum wage.
Well, it's true. And actually, in the column I've written for tomorrow's papers, it seems like the Obama agenda, when it was on the ballot without any candidates associated with it, it did fine. You know, there was a gun control initiative passed in Washington state. There were four minimum wage raises passed in red states that would never vote for Obama in an election and don't have Democratic senators. So, you know, these ideas are not the problem. It's the Democratic brand, and that's why I say, you know, reframe this argument, make a different case, do something differently, because it's not, you know, the Republicans have they have a different problem. You know, it's not the message, it's the substance, and they knew this after the 2012 election, and nothing really happened, so it'll be interesting to see what they do.
Mm-hmm. Richard, thanks for the call. Time for maybe one or two more calls for Jill. Derek in Appleton, hi.
Yeah, I think there's a disconnect between the public and reality, and I blame the fact that the public doesn't really understand, these different the different parties and what they stand for on the media. And a good example is you just mentioned the minimum wage amendments that passed, and in states where the minimum wage amendments passed, they still voted for Republican candidates. And on top of that, you know, I heard a lot of ads from Republicans saying things like the national debt is a big issue, where it's been cut by 2/3 since Obama's been in office. It's actually the lowest percentage of GDP in 40 years. I heard them running on jobs. Unemployment's down to 5.9%. I heard Republicans running on all these different economic issues, and the media never challenges them. They just let them say whatever they want to say, and people are – the American people, you know, obviously aren't the sharpest tools in the shed. They fall for this stuff because the media doesn't challenge.
Jill.
Well, we do have more and more fact-checking going on, and some of those things are challenged. And the Republicans, when they talk about the debt, that is at record levels. It's the deficit that's falling. And, of course, Democrats should have made an issue of that. They should have pointed that out, and they didn't. And, you know, the media can only do so much, and the candidates must do the rest. The media can even make suggestions, as I have in some of my columns, but if the candidates don't pick up on it, if they've come to a different conclusion, then there's nothing that we can do. The other thing is that people understand this disconnect, and it doesn't bother them. You know, there was a classic tale in one of the big newspapers about a woman in Kentucky who was benefiting tremendously from the Medicaid expansion there under Obamacare, but she was going to vote for Mitch McConnell no matter what. She knew that he said he wanted to pull it out root and branch. She didn't care. She said, I could never vote for a Democrat.
Mm. Did you get the sense, or is it just me, have there been other elections with the same kinds of candidates? It seems striking to me in this election that everybody had kind of a certain list of issues, what they were going to talk about. You had the feeling that somebody wrote what their ideas should be. They may agree with them, but they just didn't have genuineness about them. There wasn't, you know, going out on a limb in any way to take a stand on something that was important because you're afraid it's not going to poll well, or whatever focus group you've done said you shouldn't do that. So everybody becomes kind of blah.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because one of the things I did this year was a pretty in-depth study of House primaries for the Brookings Institution. And that was, you know, one of our big paper that we wrote at the end of it was called Phoning It In and Failing to Show. And the thing that was so striking, I mean, I had to laugh about this plagiarism scandal that kept cropping up here and there, you know, cutting and pasting someone's
right.
job plans or something. The websites on both sides were almost identical. The issues on both sides were almost identical. You know, you just had no creativity, no originality, no new ideas, very generic on both sides.
Right.
Everything's been nationalized and is coming from the top down.
Yeah. One more call for you, and then we switch to another guest, and let's go to Chris in Oshkosh. Hi, Chris.
Yeah, hi there, Kathleen. I wanted to know whether your guest would care to weigh in on the power that Fox News exerts over our electoral process these days. You know, they have become an absolute de facto arm of the Republican Party. I work with a number of people who skew just a little bit right of center. We spend a lot of time actually out of the country with the ability to sit around talking about issues. Over the last couple of weeks, I was with two guys who are well-educated, intelligent people, and the one thing that dominated the conversation more than anything else is how absolutely terrified they were for themselves and their families of Ebola, in spite of the fact that more Americans have been killed by O.J. Simpson than by Ebola, but it is the talking point du jour on Fox News. I think that until the Democrats are able to counter this information stream in some way, that all is really lost. Comments?
Jill.
Well, the media as a whole didn't cover itself in glory or on Ebola. I mean, it was extremely disproportionate for a while. And, you know, I'm not sure what we can do about Fox News. I would say that it's the mainstream news stations, you know, CBS, NBC, ABC, CNN, well, not CNN so much, but the three main news stations get most of the audience, you know, much higher than Fox or MSNBC or CNN. So, you know, people are still, it's the people who are self-determined, you know, they kind of self-sort themselves into these groups. And, you know, maybe that's your workplace, and I'm sorry, but, you know, generally speaking, I don't think that Ebola was a main concern, and I think it did not come up on polling as a main concern. There was a spike, and I think people realized at a certain point that it was under control.
Yeah. Jill, thank you very much for being with us. We'll look forward to your analysis in the days ahead.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Jill Lawrence, columnist for Creators Syndicate and Al Jazeera America. John McCormick, who is from Wisconsin and is senior writer for the Weekly Standard, will be with us the next part of the show to talk about Wisconsin and the Republican wave nationally as well. And we'll continue phone calls. 800-486-8655 is the number. Ebola was mentioned. We're going to be talking about Ebola the second hour of our program today, and the decision to put in quarantine healthcare workers who have been in West African nations. There was a determination in the main case of the nurse who returned from West Africa, and so we will talk about whether or not we're just overreacting to all of this, what the sensible health precautions are to take for people who have worked in the affected West African countries. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Joining us now for election analysis, he's been with us many times before on all things political, is John McCormick, senior writer for the Weekly Standard. Hello, John. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, nice to have you here. Well, it was a really, really good night for Republicans last night. Before we talk about Wisconsin, why do you think Republicans did so well in the Senate and particularly in gubernatorial races?
I was a little surprised. I mean, I think the bottom line is that the president is deeply unpopular for a number of reasons, and this is a national wave, and it was a rejection of the president's agenda. I think you've had a lot of people of a different political persuasion than me say that the election really wasn't about anything, but I would actually argue that it was, you know, I mean, on a couple big, very big issues, public opinion had turned strongly against the president on the Affordable Care Act after its bad implementation last year. People, you know, millions of people being told that they had to switch to different plans from the ones that they liked. And then the foreign policy crisis, where, you know, we thought we were going to come back and do nation building at home and, you know, get out of Iraq completely. And then to see the rise of this, you know, Al-Qaeda offshoot ISIS take over vast swaths of Syria and Iraq. The president used to have a great approval rating on terrorism. That's one of his strengths after Osama bin Laden was successfully taken out. And on those two key issues, I think the president's signature health care reform and foreign policy, that definitely helped drug his approval numbers down beyond what just a typical, you know, 6-year itch might be. Mm-hmm. So, I would say it was bigger than any one particular issue, but I do think also another data point on the healthcare law being big is that's the single, you know, most advertised issue that Republicans spent on throughout October. You know, something like a third of their ads, I might be missing.
Was it really?
There was nothing. Oh, yeah. I mean, so people are saying, oh, it really wasn't about this. Republicans ran on nothing. Well, no, I mean, a lot of them didn't have a plan to replace the health care law. They say they want that. Some of them did. Ed Gillespie out here in Virginia, he shocked everybody. He's one of the few that did. He almost won after being down 10 points on election day in the polls. Everyone thought he was down 10 points. So, you know, I do think that there were issues at stake, and it prevents some challenges to the Democratic Party, how they go forward if they think that their, you know, their demographic coalition will just show up in 2016, if they actually need to make some adjustments.
Mm-hmm. Senator McConnell has been having a press conference, as you know, the new leader of the Senate. He was asked this question. I'm never sure what this means. Does the president have a responsibility to shift toward the middle after yesterday's election? McConnell's answer, I hope that's what he does. Will you meet the president there in the middle? And his response, a divided government is not a reason not to do anything. What is all this talk about the middle? What is the middle?
Well, it's you know, it definitely depends on your perspective. I think that someone like, you know, Mitch McConnell would probably think that the middle would be something like, you know, revenue neutral tax reform, where, you know, you don't tax any less, but you sort of close out these loopholes and bring down the rates to make our tax rates competitive with, you know, over other countries and stuff like that. But the president has, you know, they have a disagreement about what, you know, the president thinks that that should yield extra revenue that I call for tax reform. But I think they think some things like that. I'm skeptical that'll happen. You know, I think that McConnell would point out to somebody like Bill Clinton, who after the big midterm defeat in 1994 did move to the center on things like welfare reform. He signed that into law, became very popular. He's known for his triangulation. And the president really didn't do that, though. I mean, after he lost big in 2010, he pretty much stuck to his guns, ran a base election in 2012, and defeated Mitt Romney. It didn't work out again in 2014. And, you know, it just depends on, from his perspective, I would say that the president, he's probably trying to, the only thing that I think would make him move to the center, so to speak, however you define the center, is his concerns that he could be so unpopular the Democrats could lose the presidency in 2016 and thereby lose his entire, you know, legacy and most of his agenda, including health care law.
And what responsibility do the Republicans have now with a majority in both houses to ensure a victory for them in the presidency in 2016?
Well, yeah, again, it's all a matter of opinion. You know, I think that, you know, they've been willing to make some small compromises in the past. And so as the president on things like spending bills, you know, after the government shut down, that was kind of a ridiculous escapade. A little bit of an agreement last year between Paul Ryan from Wisconsin, obviously, and Patty Murray, a Democratic senator from Washington State, to fund the government for 2 years. I think they'll be able to get things like that done. There might be some things, small things, like on the Keystone Pipeline, but I would be surprised if there are any, you know, really major reforms. I mean, tax reform is a thing, as I said, everyone talks about, but it's actually much more difficult to accomplish once you get down in the weeds and try and, you know, take out whichever loopholes are there. You know, you've got all these special interests who are, you know, really like their own special loopholes. So I'm not too optimistic for something to change, but it all depends. You know, if Republicans think it's in their interest to work with the president and move right and do some small things in immigration, they'll probably do that. And if the president thinks that's in his interest, he'll probably take him up on that.
But yeah.
It remains to be seen where they can meet in the center.
There has been a great deal of national attention focused on Wisconsin, and I noticed today there were all kinds of articles on the reelection win for Governor Scott Walker here in Wisconsin. Somebody from the American Spectator wrote before the election, if Walker wins on November 4, Republicans should nominate him by acclamation right then and there to be their 2016 presidential candidate. The GOP needs a fighter who can step into the ring and dish out as much as he can take. Would you agree with that? That he needs to step into the ring?
I don't get into endorsing candidates or anything, but I think it was an impressive win. You know, I mean, after all the fights that he's been through, you know, some people thought the recall might have been just a dislike of the recall, the protests in Madison. But you look at this, at the election results, and Walker won by about 6 points. That's about the same margin he won by in the 2010 Republican wave. You know, people talk about, oh, it's all about turnout. They just got their base out. We didn't get our base out. But if that's actually not the case. I went and looked, and if Mary Burke had won Milwaukee and Madison, Milwaukee and Dane counties, by the same number of votes that Barack Obama beat Mitt Romney, you know, the best that you could really do realistically, Walker still would have won. So this wasn't really about the base necessarily in different counties turning out against other counties. It was that Walker has a pretty sustainable 51-52% coalition in Wisconsin that supports him and supports what he's done. So I do think he's in a good position right now. I think his promise as a Republican presidential potential candidate is that, you know, the idea that I can govern as conservatively as possible, but no further. I'm not going to, you know, wage any kamikaze missions to shut down the government to defund Obamacare. But I am going to govern like I did in Wisconsin, where I had this reform. It was very controversial, but I saw it through. I didn't back down. You know, I got reelected. I think that is, you know, he's got a lot of vulnerabilities to be a governor. He doesn't have any really foreign policy experience, so he'll have to be able to discuss that, you know, knowledgeably and articulately. And so there's plenty of time for that, though.
Right.
You know, 2016 is 2 years away.
Yeah, it is. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. John McCormick is our guest as we do analysis of yesterday's elections. He's a senior writer for the Weekly Standard. Lines are open. We do have, here's somebody who doesn't like Governor Walker, and let's get your response to her email. This is from Wendy. Wendy, when I heard the governor last night and he was talking like a prairie populist, I sat up in bed and screamed. I think it's a wave of ignorance. Three bills to take away local control, cutting schools. We are in Marshfield, and we wonder how we can recruit the best and brightest with school cuts and the desire of professionals to have a vigorous public school with vigorous science education.
Yeah, I mean, that's a case against the governor. I don't think that that case was really articulated all that well by Mary Burke. You know, I think that Democrats sort of thought, well, we tried running the ideological campaign against him in, you know, the 2011 and 2012 work. So from my perspective, it seems like Mary Burke ran more of a, you know, kind of a Herb Kohl campaign. You know, Wisconsin is known for these, you know, bold conservatives and bold liberals like Tammy Baldwin, Ron Johnson, Scott Walker, and, you know, LaFollette back in the day as a progressive Republican. But, you know, we also have someone like Herb Kohl, who is, a nice guy, pretty much a generic Democrat, very wealthy, and was able to win re-election, or run election a bunch of times in Wisconsin. I think Mary Burke sort of followed that model, thought that, you know, I'm just going to, you know, not rock the boat too much. I'm going to hold Walker accountable for not living up to his promise of creating 250,000 new jobs during his first term. She was very, you know, determined to focus on that like a laser. Didn't really get into the, you know, the school cuts and, you know, the collective bargaining issues. So whether that was a mistake, I don't know. You know, I think if you look at the Marquette polls, it probably wasn't a mistake because Act 10 is supported by a majority. So I think that she, you know, she tried something different and it didn't work out.
We were talking with our earlier guest about kind of a blandness to many of the campaigns, particularly on the Democratic side, that you didn't have a lot of people being genuine. You felt like they were all on their certain talking points, actually both sides, Republicans and Democrats, and nobody stepped outside those talking points. Did you get a sense that that was the way? And if so, it must have been a plan for a lot of campaigns to conduct themselves this go around.
I definitely thought that was the case in Wisconsin when I was on the ground there. You know, it was remarkable that sort of, you know, Scott Walker was just content to, you know, let Mary Burke make this argument with the economy, and he was going to make his counter-argument, though. Hey, well, you know, under Jim Doyle, they lost 100,000 jobs, and, you know, we've got to 100,000 now, and we're almost there. And he really didn't, you know, make this a big election about his reforms. You know, she didn't try and bring that up, and he did a little bit more towards the end, I would say, in his TV ads, but it definitely didn't seem to be. It was, you know, all focused on, you know, jobs numbers and then, you know, personality issues. Walker had this John Doe investigation, and Mary Burke had copied some parts of her jobs plan, and, you know, may or may not have been let go from her, you know, Trek bicycle for whatever reason at the very end. So, yeah, it did seem like small issues there, which was surprising. I mean, if you thought back, you know, 3-4 years ago, and you looked at Wisconsin and you asked them, well, what's Scott Walker's reelection campaign going to be about? And they said, well, obviously, it's going to be about these very controversial, you know, union education issues that consumed Madison, sparked all these protests. But, you know, Mary Burke didn't choose to go that route after the 2012 recall. I think she felt that had been litigated and wanted to try the economic jobs campaign.
Yeah. Well, and it's true that in exit polls all over the country, the number one, people feel they're on real tenuous ground when it comes to the economy and when it comes to their own finances. Do you get a strong sense from yesterday, or will we need to wait a few years to see which party can better handle people's uncertainty about money, about their own finances?
Yeah, I mean, you're definitely, it's kind of the economy is sort of it's at a strange place right now.
Yeah.
Where, I mean, objectively, you would say the economy is doing better, right? I mean, it's not great, but it's doing better than it was in 2010 when it was in the gutter after the collapse. It's doing better than 2012 probably when unemployment was still up above 7%, so people are getting jobs. But I think the issue is really sort of this paycheck issue where people correctly, you know, the average family, a typical family in America has less money now to take home than they did back in 2007. So you think after 7 years, the average American has less money to spend. You've had inflation that's been small, but over, you know, over 7 years, even 1 or 2% of inflation adds up. So I do think the economy played an issue, played a significant role. But given the fact that the economy is better now than it was in 2010 or 2012, I do tend to look at other issues, primarily foreign policy and the implementation of the affordable issues in the 2014 election. Mm.
Thank you so much, John, for being with us. Appreciate your time always.
Thank you, Kathleen.
John McCormick giving us his analysis. John is a senior writer for the Weekly Standard, and he is from Wisconsin and spent quite a bit of time on the ground covering the gubernatorial race in our state. Thanks to John. Thanks to Jill Lawrence, columnist for Creators Syndicate and Al Jazeera America, and Craig Gilbert, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Tomorrow at this time, we will be discussing the status of girls in Wisconsin. Alverno College Research Center for Women and Girls and the Girl Scouts of Wisconsin have collaborated on the report to be released tomorrow, and representatives from each organization will be joining us. So that's tomorrow during this time period. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the hour, and to Lisa Nalbandian for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee.